Welcome to Mac and Blue, the cutting-edge podcast for the nation's builders, merging the realms of construction with exciting advancements in technology. Join us on a thrilling journey where we delve into the dynamic world of blockchain, AI, the metaverse, virtual and augmented reality, and their transformative impact on the industry. Our engaging discussions span a wide spectrum, covering not only construction, economic development, supply chain, and market segments, but also exploring the vibrant tapestry of diversity within the construction landscape. We shed light on the intersection of local politics and its profound influence on the construction sector, while championing the remarkable contributions of women and minorities in construction. For all things Mac and Blue, head to www.macandblue.com and don't forget to subscribe on YouTube. I'm your host, JJ Levinsky. Now let's get into it.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Mac and Blue. I'm your host, JJ Levinsky, CEO and co-founder of Blue Wave. Today, we've got an international guest, Ditte Lisgaard, who's with The Circular Way, and she's also the chairwoman of the Danish Design Council. I will, before I get into asking her questions, I do have to read a little bit of her bio because it's pretty darn cool. So she's author of Danish Design Heritage and Global Sustainability. She is renowned in the circular economy area. She is based in Denmark. She has lived in the United States in New York, which she'll get into in a little bit. And she's kind of known for pioneering a bunch of business models and just crazy cool stuff. So I was very excited when, I think one of her publicists and PR people reached out to me and said, hey, can we get Ditte on your podcast? And once I looked into her, I was like, hell yeah. She's a nice disruptor. So we thought we'd get her on here. So with that, Ditte, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, it's by different layers. It started with business school and working with the renewable energy company while studying at university at the Copenhagen Business School, Ørsted, which is the renewable wind, and then sort of getting to understand, wait, there's actually an opportunity for business and climate to be prerequisite rather than opposites, and then working more and more within that space, going into the waste management industry, but a little bit by chance, starting to work with a product as a service clothing company. So, and at that point, it was 2014. We didn't know that there was something called the circular economy, or let alone circular business models and materials. But it just made so much sense because in a product as a service business model, you design materials, products, and business model that incentivize quality, so use rather than exchange value. And from there, it just grew little by little, understanding, okay, circularity is to happen, then it needs to be about design, and design is sort of the way, what I see as the tool to make sustainability not just about doing less bad, or, you know, sort of not being able to do anything at all, but more of saying there's a way forward where sustainability isn't just about what we shouldn't do, but sort of creating a way forward on how can we create value for people while staying within the planetary boundaries.
For the audience sake, can you give, before we get into all the fun questions and all that kind of stuff, let everyone know kind of the background, because naturally there's more of an American base here. What got you into design in the first place, and kind of talk a little bit more about that background, just from the design perspective?
Yeah, so I think the thing about what and why I wrote like also a book on the sort of like with inspiration from the Danish design heritage is that Danish design is, you know, form follows function, and that doesn't mean that the form is less bad or the aesthetics is less bad, but it's all about providing use value and functionality. So from a sort of you know, societal from birth almost perspective, Danes are very used to design, not so much from these, you know, lots of ornaments and sort of fancy things, but just a sort of like, you know, how your bus stop is designed, how your thermostat for, you know, measuring the heat in your apartment, how your toilet is, all of these everyday objects are just very, very well thought through with care for the material, for the craft, and for the form, but all with the purpose of giving it the highest functionality possible. So it's very sort of embedded, and then you, so you don't necessarily see it at first, but then you start realizing how big a part that is and how there's that opportunity to cater to human beings without compromise if we make it about caring for the use value and the value of the craft and the material.
Where did you start off when you were originally in the design space? What did that look like in, you've been in the States, but what did it look like in Denmark or Europe when you first got into design? How is the European model different than what the reader or what the listeners and viewers here expect from a design perspective?
Yeah, I think it goes on so many levels. Like, you know, sort of like here in Copenhagen, the natural thing for me is to go outside and wherever I need to go within at least a 10 kilometers distance or 10, 15 kilometers distance, my bike will be the most advantageous mode of transportation because the city is designed for a bike. So that'll be one. My heat system is fairly cheap and quite sustainable from a systematic point compared to the US because it's district energy and sharing of energy. Again, the sort of the systems design for it. And it looks good because someone took the time and care to make sure that the radiators, the thermostats, everything was designed for it. Then on the material perspective, from a US perspective to a Danish perspective, and of course there can be variations and times all also to some degree changing, but we'll have more mono materials of higher quality in terms of making sure that the building lasts for a very, very long time, can be repaired rather than having to be discarded completely. So those are some of the things in terms of how, you know, the individual apartment or house, the material used, and then going to the mobility and the energy system as well, which I think is a key component of design, right? It's from the sort of small, you know, how you plug in your energy to your, you know, your furniture, to the energy system, mobility, sort of broader city design. All of it is part of the design realm.
With that, Ditte, can you think of any examples, again, that would, like, let's use your experience in New York. So, you know, the quintessential American looks at a New York studio apartment versus maybe what you had designed in Copenhagen. What would be the tangible differences that you can describe to the audience in that form meets function type mentality that you were raised in and then, you know, you're advocating for, which we'll get into more with the circular economy. But I want to relate. I'm trying to build some building blocks for the audience to understand and appreciate that.
I think there is a sort of, if you look at from the building perspective, you have the operational energy and the embedded carbon. So, you know, like sort of the operational energy being where energy efficiency of when you have a finished building and you're living in it comes into play, where the embedded carbon is the energy used while building the building, building the materials. And if you look at operational energy, there you have a market that works without subsidies. There's really, really high functioning, very large scale, global businesses coming out of Denmark, Danfoss, Grundfos, these types of companies that are really have made it their business to help reduce energy cost and save energy. So that can function in a sort of classical no subsidy kind of market scheme. When you look at the embedded carbon, it gets a little bit more blurry. So there's definitely some things that can happen without subsidies, but in order to get scale as quickly as we need it, there are definitely also some of the materials that are either coming with subsidies or there's talk about should we do some sort of carbon tax of some sort. So there's both, but from the energy efficiency game, we're really, really far. With the embedded carbon, there's still a bit more road to go, at least for some of the materials. that set when you talk of sort of about of lenders, the European Union with their taxonomy, investors are really starting to change because they need to do their ESG reporting on it. So rather it's Denmark, it's Germany, it's a lot of different of the economies. There is more and more of financial institutions, banks, and institutional investors that are either saying, we will only invest, you risk that your whatever development that you've done, if you're not performing well on ESG, that will become a stranded asset because there's just not a lot of exit opportunities for you in a not too distant future. So there's also a market drive there. On the other side, from a lending perspective and the banks in particular, they're starting to say, if you're not performing on ESG, it's either going to be more costly, the cost of capital is going to be higher, or which is, I think, for the industry even worse than that, is that you're not going to be able to gear in the same degree. You won't have the same amount of capital available for whatever development you're doing if you're not performing well on ESG. So, which is driven at least to a large degree, not only but to a large degree by the European Union and their legislation, but. There's no perfect solution, but from my perspective, they're starting to be market really taking that over and then using market mechanisms to drive that change rather than it's, you know, very strictly regulated from either national or European legislation of sort of like this technology versus this technology. It's more the market that are driving it by pricing in the cost of not doing it sustainable.
Very well stated. And I'm going to probably start going off on a bunch of tangents and go down a bunch of rabbit holes. One of the things I wanted to ask you on that is, and this will get into the circular economy thing, which we'll touch. How do I ask this question? Because you've been in both you've been around the world, but specifically to the U.S. versus maybe, you know, the Scandinavian countries or whatever. Let's keep Southern Europe out of this for a minute, just for perspective. Is you were talking about the energy thing. I am curious if that's driven by capitalism or more by, and I don't want to use this as a negative connotation, but socialism. In other words, are there subsidies in place in Denmark from the government that helps that, whereas you've seen in the U.S., it's all pure capitalism. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's more capitalism and less subsidy, less government interference on those kind of things. So is it easier, harder? Just think about the energy part, because where I'm going with this is, okay, Ditta, that's great. But from a performer perspective, which we'll get into the economics of this, if you have to put, 15% more in the CapEx to put that product out there, are the lenders going to lend the money to the developer to build it to recapture that? Which is, again, what we're getting into the circular economy discussion, both the pros and the cons, because a lot of people don't understand it. They want, hey, Ditta, what does this all mean? You know? So go ahead and try to unravel that whole.
Yeah. So it's a reporting scheme when you report on environmental, social, and governance. So, you know, your environmental performance, your social performance, and your governance in terms of, you know, who's part of the decision-making process, are your decision-making processes transparent, and all these different questions that really very much are key to also solving some of these problems.
Sorry, and thank you for defining that. I just wanted to, a lot of people know it now that you've clarified it. My question for you on the ESG is, Is it more formal in Europe, or do you see it being a? I mean, I hear it about it here in the U.S. and North America, but have, like, let's say Canada and the U.S. have they? And forgive me for not knowing this. Have the governments or different regulatory agencies, have they been more inclined to gravitate it towards it and copy any of the European models? I'm just kind of curious. I'm sure the audience would be interested to hear about that.
Yeah. I think that there's a beginning towards doing more, but for me, I think the value, like, there, because there's also a lot of conversations of, you know, does ESG make sense? Is it just sort of a a proxy or sort of like these greenwashing schemes. Yeah, these techniques, it's not really. And I think for me, the reason why I sort of hold on to it is because I think it's, at least in a European perspective, it's an umbrella term that the construction sector and industry at large can relate to. And so it's, you know, rather than it being one thing or one, you know, regulatory framework, it's sort of the umbrella notion for all of the things in terms of being mindful of both positive and negative societal impact that one might have.
Thank you. Let's go back. I tend to do this sometimes. I get going so far down our interview that I probably should go back. And I would love for you to give your definition for the audience's sake of what the circular economy means, because I think so many people look at it in different parameters. If you could give your definition, then I'd love to start talking about some of the experiences you've had, the case studies, because then I think it goes into all sorts of cool conversations that we can have during the remainder of the podcast. So with that, Ditta, if you could just start with the ethos and the premise about what the circular economy is.
For me, the circular economy is a tool to provide value for people while staying within the planetary boundaries. So, you know, allowing for us to cater to global demand without compromising Mother Earth by, you know, either emitting too much CO2 or using too many resources, thus compromising our biodiversity. But that also means that it's quite deliberate that I call it a tool that helps us achieve a goal rather than seeing the fact that we circulate something as a goal in itself. And within that, there's, for me, I try to sort of operationalize it by seeing four different avenues. So there's reduce. We can reduce our amount of packaging materials. We can probably also, you know, reduce the amount of clothes we buy without compromising on our well-being. So reducing materials, reducing consumption. Then there's reuse, getting better at utilizing our products to a higher degree. We talked about the Danish design tradition and heritage. Our furniture tradition is a very key example of that. I live almost solely with old furniture that are sort of from the 30s, 40s, 60s, and the quality of them are just extremely high, so they can be kept in use. I think actually they're better quality than what.
You mean you don't buy the Swedish IKEA stuff?
Because I think that goes to sort of like the, you know, the reduce the amount of consumption necessary, and there is, you know, rather it's fast fashion, fast furniture, fast living, there is an issue with the fast whatever element we're talking about that IKEA of course also represents on furniture. What I do like is that there's an element to it where you have some sort of quality at a reasonable price, which I think if you want to be a little bit critical about Danish design today, they've not all. I have a few examples in the book, such as brands Takt, Meda, etc., that are trying to say, wait, the Danish design heritage was about quality, but it was also about a democratic price point or a price point where, you know, the majority could be part of it. It's not, you know, it's not sustainable if it's only for a very few percentage of the population. So in that sense, IKEA is delivering on providing value for people within a monetary frame that is achievable. And the Danish design needs to remember that that's also a part of sustainability. That said, in terms of circularity, the last two for me would be recycling. And the last would be replace. So all of the biogenic materials, wood, algae, mycelium, whatnot, we could talk about today. And from a practical perspective, I've been working the most with is recycling of materials. So taking plastic, textiles, waste stream and turning them, rather than seeing them incinerated or landfilled, turning them into new materials and providing new value, and seeing that that design is the tool to do that, because design allows us to, one, question, you know, the current ways of doing, and sort of seeing, wait, does it need to be that way? We see it as maybe being natural, but it's something that we socially constructed. And then secondly, help us shape what hasn't yet have gotten shape. So there's, you know, science is very, very good at telling us what we need to leave behind in terms of climate change, but we really need to get much better at then sort of shaping what is it that we might move towards, that where we cater to people and people's need while staying within the planetary boundaries. And I think when we combine the circular economy and recycling in particular with design, that's where there can sort of be a lot of really good solutions. So that's I talk about also this sort of, you know, bridging theory and practice, and that's where magic happens. And I think that's very much one of those places where that really happens.
There comes a time when dreams become a reality, when you see your vision materialize into a true work of art. And the only way to get there is to choose a general contractor who shares that same vision and knows how to bring it to life. At Blue Wave, we aren't so big that we've forgotten where we've come from, and we aren't so small that we can't care for your projects regardless of their size. When your vision deserves safety, perfection, timeliness, and expertise in order to become a reality, trust Blue Wave to get it done right the first time.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, Ditta. I would like, with your permission, I'd like it to go. Well, there's two things I want to address. One, I want to go through the reduce, reuse, recycling, and replace at a granular level in the conversation. But you keep mentioning the planetary boundaries. I think a lot of people would like to know who defines the planetary boundaries, because there's no God or deity that's doing this. So it comes down to people, you know, government, those kind of things. And I'm not looking for a black and white answer, but in the world that you play in, as you're teaching and advocating around the world for this kind of stuff, what are those planetary boundary guidelines, or what are some of the targets that you can talk to it around? Because otherwise it's just this ambiguous numbers of CO2 or this or water, or whatever. I mean, Help the audience understand, like, what governance or what guidelines are you guys going after on these planetary boundaries?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So around, actually, which is by coincidence, it first really started to being a conversation around it when there was the COP15 in Copenhagen, which is it didn't go that well, but that was actually when Copenhagen hosted the climate talks. And there was this Swedish scientist, Johan Rockström, who was at that point at the Stockholm Resilience Center. Now he's in Germany at the Potsdam Institute. But he and I think about 15 other scientists at that point, and now it's just grown massively since then. But they came around and said, okay, what is it actually that we need to measure on, that we need to know in order to find what they call a safe operating space. So sort of saying, you know, we can't just stop doing anything. So we need something where we can say, like, what are actually, you know, the our sort of playing field, what can we work within? And then they found these 9 boundaries to be the sort of key boundaries that set. What they're also saying is, yes, there are 9 boundaries, but there are 2 that if we deliver on them, and they are climate change and biodiversity, we can make it work, even though we're not delivering as much, like we're sort of crossed the other 7. But on the other side, we can deliver on the 7 others, but if we're crossing climate change and biodiversity, it won't do as much good to have stayed within the seven. So there, while there's nine, there's two that are more sort of fundamental than the other, or even more important. But they are all relevant to be mindful of. And then they do these continued scientific analyses of, you know, how close or far are we from crossing the boundaries from each planetary boundaries, and sort of then what might be some of these tipping points, and are they irreversible in terms of that. So that's the sort of framework, saying that there are scientists that helps us from an international perspective navigate what are the safe operating space that we have to work within when creating value for people.
Thank you. Can we go back now and talk about the four pillars, if you will, the reduce, reuse, recycle, and replace. If you could, again, based on what I'd seen you do in other podcasts and your teaching elements, I think the audience would love to hear examples of each of what you've done. And it doesn't have to be in construction. It could be in retail, or, like, I know you've got some clothing type examples. So if you could spend as much time as you want on, let's just go right through them. So start with reduce. What have you guys, or what has the circular economy and in your teachings and the design world, give some examples of what you've really targeted, maybe some success stories, maybe in some that weren't success stories. I think the audience would love to hear that.
You know, energy efficiency is a great example of it. When we reduce what we need to use while giving up the quality of life, but it comes, so it can be, you know, reducing our energy consumption, reducing our use of material. We've worked a lot with sort of within the packaging design. How do we package using less material? I remember this in the first book, which is called A Changemaker's Guide to the Future. I had this interview with an American woman, Kate, who had done this. She used in Closed Loop Fund, and she had done this partnership for Starbucks and McDonald's that had come together on this pre-competitive partnership. And the task was, how do we create a more sustainable straw for all of the different drinks that they had? And at one point, it sort of came down to, wait, maybe we should try to do create some sort of cup that doesn't require a straw. So we could, it's actually just reduce the amount of material necessary. So they tried working with different elements within that. And I think that's, it goes back to that sort of questioning, what do we actually need? In Denmark, what we work with now, because while Danes are good at creating sustainable solutions, we are actually not that sustainable in our way of living. One of the areas being that we tend to live on very many square meters per person. So now trying to work with, from an architectural perspective, how can we live on a little fewer square meters, but without reducing the quality of life? When we talk about reuse, there's, of course, a lot of, you know, reusing one product from one to the next, but also an increasing amount of platforms. So technology solutions that enables the reuse, knowing where it's come from, where it's going, you know, where is their availability, but also what I touched upon initially, that, you know, you can create a business model around reuse where it's also incentivized to produce quality, which is the product as a service business model. My first endeavor within circularity was that, which was a baby clothing company that, where originally the founder had worked with wanting to do better. So started buying organic cotton and these types of things, but then realizing, wait, one, I'm still depending on selling as much as possible people not really using the product as much as possible. And secondly, once, you know, organic cotton is more expensive than regular cotton, so it also became a fairly niche product rather than a sort of what we need for a broader audience, which I think we all have a responsibility from a human-to-human perspective to make sure that it's available for a broad audience. But, you know, the bigger the scale, the bigger is the impact. So we also need it from an environmental sustainability perspective. And then the product as a service business model, when you start utilizing the product as much as possible, you get the environmental benefit, but you also make it possible for many more people to get that organic cotton than would have otherwise been the case. Recycling, it's all of the materials. So, you know, you have a product, you no longer use it for that product. So you have an element of processing and then separating of some sort and then using that to create a new product. So for me, the sort of the key or the most the thing I've spent the most time on was to take with my team, where we had the Carlsberg brewery, so beer, and where they had moved from steel kegs to this plastic composite keg, which had benefits in terms of reducing the amount of beer wasted and all these different things, but meant that it had to be a composite plastic. So a composite plastic being plastic put together from a number of different polymers in order to, you know, be able to be outside and, you know, the crisp of the beer and all these different things. And that they had not been able to find a sort of a tangible business model for that to be recycled. Because when it's a composite, it is, you know, you need to spend the cost of separating, and so it's not really financially viable in most cases. But by putting design first, we saw that we could actually turn it into tables, chairs, a lot of these different products. So making sure that the plastic was recycled and put into use again, rather than new oil needed to be used to produce that plastic element. And then replace is one of the things that I think we're just in the starting phase of. So in the book, I sort of separate between first generation bio-based materials and next generation bio-based materials. And the first generation would be the most sort of in use and obvious would be wood, but also looking at hemp and even sort of different plant materials that can that we have. We could almost call it innovation by remembrance, because we've done it before. I think hemp was one of the materials that Henry Ford actually used for the cars back in the days, and then hemp because it was used for other purposes was then no longer allowed, and then he couldn't do it anymore. But just to say, we do know if we think back that it's really high quality materials, and we just sort of forgot that. So there's a lot of the bio-based materials where we can replace some of the materials with a high amount of embedded carbon with new materials that on the opposite actually stores carbon. So it's like almost you know, if you built a wood building, you store carbon rather than have it emitted into air. The next generation bio-based materials is where I think it gets really interesting, and where Denmark, for one, has a huge commercial opportunity, because we have a very large life science sector. And life science, you know, it's medicine. Novo Nordisk is a very sort of, it's the most valuable company in Europe now. But what they do is a bioengineering, so taking our natural materials and using engineering to make sure that it performs to how it would work best. So sort of taking, you know, the lessons of nature and combining it with our human ingenuity, we can work with algae that can be as you know, perform better than oil-based plastics. In the future, building with mycelium, you know, even using carbon as a material. There's a very large amount of materials out there and opportunities out there that we are only just starting to work with. Because if you think back, it's almost as if for a long time, you know, looking at concrete, plastics, you know, being smart, being intelligent was almost as if you're like, the further away we can get away from you know, the natural state, the smarter we are as human beings. Where now with the bio-based materials and the next generation, it's more of saying, wait, let's combine forces and, you know, work with nature, and use all of that human ingenuity to make nature even better, so that we can really do even more. Because, you know, there's a need for improved strength, but in particularly also if we want to build something with mycelium or even wood, there's an issue of making sure that it happens at the speed and scale necessary for modern production.
That was a mouthful. Thank you for encapsulating all four of those pillars. I've got some questions that I want to go down based on what you just shared. What have you done? Can you go into the, maybe this is the recycling part, Dina, but the waste streams, like if you can, maybe in Denmark you have a better sense than here in the U.S. How are you getting upstream of those waste streams to talk to those people for the recycling? Are there any examples you can give? I think the audience would love to say, like, all right, Dina, give me an example of waste streams into recycling.
Yeah. To some degrees, we're good at it in Denmark. A lot of ways, you actually have an advantage in the US, because one of the issues is in Denmark is that it's municipal, so it's very much coming from the waste management sector, and each city has its own, which makes it super difficult to invest in the technology and the capabilities necessary to really move upstream and make it less, you know, sort of traditionally waste management has been about, you know, your product was to make something go away. And now we need to actually make that, you know, waste stream desirable.
There comes a time when dreams become a reality, when you see your vision materialize into a true work of art. And the only way to get there is to choose a general contractor who shares that same vision and knows how to bring it to life. At Blue Wave, we aren't so big that we've forgotten where we've come from, and we aren't so small that we can't care for your projects regardless of their size. When your vision deserves safety, perfection, timeliness, and expertise in order to become a reality, trust Blue Wave to get it done right the first time.
No, that's a good example. But it's funny. Well, okay, so go. I guess where my mind's going, Dad, is kind of the, I don't know what the word is, like the juxtaposition of, okay, let's take all these old plastics and put those into polymers and, you know, recycle the plastics. But I also almost feel like that's contradictory in what you're saying, is that with the technology that's out there, instead of, you're almost switching from recycling to replace, the biogenics are the future. Because let's take that plastic. If I recycle the plastic once and put it into, I'll just make up something, put it into a polymer that goes in the concrete, I'm never going to get that back out again. That's one and done. Because by the time I recycle that concrete, the plastic can't be reused again. The concrete can, but not that plastic. Whereas with the biogenics, we have almost like this never ending circular economy. Hello, while you're on the show. So how does someone like you that sees all this, you know, better than the average person, how do you teach and convince people or educate people to go, well, that's a generation of technology ago. We now have to focus more on this. do you struggle with like industry and like you call it municipalities almost being too far behind the curve in making this sustainable? Is that a fair question?
Yeah, it's a super fair question, and it's super difficult. I think for me, it's something I struggle with as well. And one of my sort of solutions for handling that is when we work with the different waste streams, the Carlsberg plastics as one, being super mindful of not putting too much CapEx into the solution, because knowing that it's actually not a long-term solution, the problem won't be there long-term. And if we put in a lot of CapEx, then we actually become financially dependent on the problem still being there when a better solutions come up there. So I think there's something in being agile in, you know, the you know, how much CapEx, how long of a sort of a period of return of investment do you put, and then being mindful of flexibility when you built something. Is it, can you, do you have to start from scratch, or can you alternate an existing production facility? Is there an opportunity to design for disassembly or design for flexibility and modularity, so that you know that most likely it will be something different in the future? I think this sort of the district energy system is a good example of that, where you sort of, you know, you're just, that system is created. So it's all the sort of what you put into the individual houses is hot water, and you create heating by hot water. But, and that's decentralized at every household. But the sort of the source that provides the heating of the water is central, so much easier to change from one source to another depending on where we are from a technology perspective. One thing is for certain. Yeah, I think the only thing we can know for sure is that in 5 years' time, there will be so many things that have happened that, you know, we don't have the mental capacity to fully sort of see that through, because, you know, things that we couldn't imagine will be there. And there are right now a number of different technologies, and we need a multiple of them, but we're not going to use them all. And so there will be sort of technology winners and losers. And we can't, and that, you know, it's not just about technology which wins. It's about culture and sociology and economy, and what is in, you know, who's in, you know, who in existing industry, or this, like, there's so many things in place that means we can't necessarily say which technologies will be the winners. So we need to be super mindful and agile in working with that in that space. That said, when we talk about the sort of...
I was going to interrupt you and ask, with that, how do you... The people that push back on some of these initiatives that say, all right, Ditta, that's great, but where's the pro forma? How does the financials work out on this? Are there another group of people that support you that are running the numbers all the time to say, you know, here's the capital, here's the investors, here's the return on investment? I think a lot of people want to know that. It's like, great, this ESG stuff, we believe in it, Ditta, but we can't afford it. How do you come back, and how do you respond to all the people out there that put up roadblocks in front of you going, it's not sustainable? Like you said, we can't afford that heavy CapEx if the technology is only going to last for 2 years, where we can't get our return on investment before the next new thing comes. So if you can, I'm sure you've had to encounter this question before. How do you support the data? Who's working on the data to help, you know, have design meet the circular economy type things that your team's working on?
Yeah. So I think with, you know, you have sort of the Suez Canal was blocked for a while. Material had a difficulty passing through. Those types of situations make circularity more beneficial, because then you actually have very local value change, and you don't have those same supply chain issues. So that's, there are some of these very tangible examples. Secondly, when you start from a financial perspective, there is a lot of capital flowing this way. One example being that private equity firms are starting to see that they can get a premium. So there's an interest in sort of flipping a traditional company towards green, because that will actually provide a green premium higher than they would, you know, that they can. It's a better business than if they were, you know, just doing their traditional private equity flipping of sort of efficiency. So there's those types of examples where we really still need to do a lot of work with providing the tangible examples. Is how do we make it beneficial for the end consumer and making sure that it's not either environmentally sustainable or at a fair price for you. And there's something in terms of pricing in externalities, then there's a lot in terms of moving from pilot project and all of the costs of innovation to mainstream and utilizing all of the existing infrastructure from a sort of tangible hardware infrastructure, but also all of the knowledge that existing industry has in terms of quality insurance, sourcing, all of these different things. So really starting to move up in scale for the sake of impact, but also because we know that, you know, the importance of economy of scales, and that's something that we still need to explore more. But again, one sort of example is the energy efficiency agenda, where we really see that we can have value for people and planet rather than them being opposite.
Next question is in regards to like academia, the academics that are out there, specifically in the biogenic space and things of that nature. How are you able to, again, out in what you're doing with the advocacy of the circular economy and the design as a tool towards those kind of things, how are you able to bridge academia with the capital markets or, you know, the deployment of any of these ideas? Because, you know, academics typically like to be in a bubble over here and capitalists like to be over here, and it takes people like you to bridge those together. Do you have any stories or struggles or successes of how that's taking place, especially on the biogenic side?
Yeah, I think one thing that comes to mind is mycelium. And so not too long ago, the Danish government decided that part of the Royal Danish Academy, which is the architecture school, design school and conservation school, along with a lot of other universities, had to not just be located in Copenhagen, but also be part of the entire Denmark and have sort of, you know, decentralized locations. And for the Royal Academy, that meant starting up an education in the city of Kalundborg, which is more than anything sort of the home of Novo Nordisk production land. And then it was like, oh, what's going to happen here? And then the professor from the Royal Academy, Phil, who's the sort of mycelium professor there, he was extremely excited because he could just see the amount of opportunity from going to the land of life science and everything going on there, because that was one-to-one the learnings that he needed to have. It's in different scale because built material is much bigger scale, but what actually happens is exactly the same. And so I think that's some of the things where we can learn across industries, because there are actually industries, life science in particular, that are extremely good at utilizing science to do business development. And a sector such as construction really needs to learn from that if we're going to get there in time. Otherwise, we see that the solutions will come from other industries. And we actually have an example of that, where it's an American company coming out, and I forget which university, but they're called BioMason, and it's a cement replacement that is created by mimicking how coral reefs produce lime mortar. And that then sort of some of their first investors then became Novo Nordisk Holding, so the holding company behind Novo Nordisk, and then sort of leveraging to create, you know, to create a sort of a cement replacement for construction, but utilizing all of the knowledge from life science. They now have quite a lot of work in Denmark, setting up a new sort of cement tile, like working with a cement tile producer here. So really, that's, I think, is a good example of life science being someone that are really, really good at creating the environmental transformation necessary while doing really good business development that we can learn from. And even specifically with like the example of Biomason coming out of an American university, and then by having the investment from a life science player and the knowledge from there, commercializing that at a quicker pace than is at least normal within the construction sector.
That's a lot. And I thank you. I was just looking, we're probably going to wrap it up here pretty quickly. But with that, Ditta, I want to have you take the last few minutes and explain how people can watch you, follow you. I think this was very inspiring. And I thank you to your publicists and people that reached out to us to try to get you on this show, because it definitely has a unique position within what we're trying to do at Mac and Blue and pay it forward and open up these topics of conversation. So with that, I want to give you this opportunity to kind of do a little pitch for yourself or anything that you're doing on the design side with the circular economy. So how can people follow you, watch your videos, you know, learn more? And then kind of conversely, what else do you have coming out in 2024? Are there any symposiums or large, you know, functions either globally or back in the U.S. that people can be on the lookout for?
Yeah. So I think the best sources, because on top there's quite a bit going on in 2024, but on the circularway.com, there's a point to trying to sort of keep that as updated as possible with events and everything going on. And then otherwise, Instagram, which is just my full name, is also where I try to at least sort of give a sort of snapshot of how, you know, working with different materials, different solutions, what's going on, hopefully providing some a bit more sort of tangible, like that's the power of images, right? It becomes a bit more tangible, less words and more sort of tangible pictures is another source of inspiration.
That's perfect. So in closing, anyone that's interested, follow her and any of her cohorts and people that are around this on any of the social media channels. And if you're really up to it, get on a plane and go over and see her in Copenhagen. Enjoy the beautiful city and all the things that they're doing over there. So, Ditta, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. And appreciate the good work. Keep it going forward. And I know you're a busy woman, so thanks again.
Likewise, and thank you so much for having me and a very nice conversation.
You've been listening to the Mac and Blue Show, brought to you by Blue Wave General Contracting. Be sure to subscribe to the Mac and Blue podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Follow JJ Levinsky on LinkedIn and Instagram. Tune in every Monday